Hey guys, it's Jill. Jen and I wanted to give you a heads up about the content on today's episode. It may be triggering for more sensitive audiences. Refer to the show notes for more specifics. And take care while you listen.
On this episode of Common Mystics, we give voice to Elizabeth Shaw, a vulnerable young woman who was, unfortunately, a victim of her time. I'm Jennifer James.
I'm Jill Stanley.
We're psychics.
We're sisters.
We are common mystics. We find extraordinary stories in ordinary places. And today's story takes us to colonial New England, Hampton, Connecticut.
So guys, thank you so much for tuning in this week, but I just want to give you a heads up. This is a tragic, triggering stories. It's a trigger palooza. So if you want to skip it, we'll check in with you in 2 weeks because it's a hard story to deliver. I ain't going to lie to you.
It is, but there's also an uplifting message at the end, I hope.
I hope too. Okay, guys, you know what we do. Jen, they know what we do.
They should know what we do by now.
Yeah. So what do we do? Jen and I, what do we do? Jen and I get in my car and we set the intention with spirit to help us find a verifiable story previously unknown to us that gives voice to the voiceless. And then when we are driving around and taking notes, we take those hits that we've written in the field and we research them, hoping to have a story find us through the pages of history. But sometimes, Jennifer, sometimes our hits are also relevant to another story. And there's another voiceless that is trying to get our attention, as the case with one Elizabeth Shaw. And that's why we developed the More Voices from the Road. So here we are. Let's talk Elizabeth Shaw, how we found her.
Thank you for that setup.
You're welcome.
We were in New England. We were traveling east on Route 6 from Hartford, Connecticut, passing through modern-day Hampton, Connecticut.
True statement.
Mm-hmm. And in the notes, I indicated that we were on Route 6 and that you said it was haunted AF.
Well, this is the thing. You never, like Jennifer Lover, very smart girl, does not have a good sense of direction any kind of whereabouts in the world she is. So the fact that she wrote down the route we were on for whatever reason was significant to me.
Yeah.
And when I was going over the notes with her in the car when she was telling me what she was writing, I was like, yeah, and this road is haunted AF. Mm-hmm. So that was significant. What else were we feeling?
You were picking up on persecuted women, remember?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am, I was. And I said Hester Prynne.
You did. Do you even know, like, who that is?
Not intimately. We never met, no.
Okay. Well, Hester Prynne is a fictional character, Jill, from Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel The Scarlet Letter, which many of us read in high school because it was mandatory reading. And Hester Prynne, you might remember, she's the woman who was publicly shamed for adultery and forced to wear a scarlet letter A on her chest. And she committed adultery and she got pregnant and she had a baby. And it was this whole thing and she was publicly shamed. And this was set in Puritan, Massachusetts in the 1600s.
Who is the dude?
I don't remember his name.
Did he have a letter?
He did not have to wear a letter.
Hmm.
Yeah, I know. That doesn't seem fair, does it?
No. It seems a little hypocritical. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you were picking up on the feelings of despair.
Yes.
Like real thick sadness.
And also people giving their lives. In
you
other
heard
words,
that quote, and that's chilling.
I heard a voice say people gave their lives.
Mm-hmm. Ugh, that's ominous.
And you were picking up on an event or a gathering? Talk to me about that.
In the town square. Oh my gosh. Do you ever you remember Beauty and the Beast and Belle is like in the town square and everyone's in the town square and they're like all singing? Like that's what I was picking up. Like there was like a crowded town square and people were there for an event. There was something happening there.
Okay. But it was somber in nature, you imagine?
Somber. It was not jovial like Beauty and the Beast.
Okay, so there wasn't Beauty and singing. And
yeah, okay. Belle was not there. She was not singing. It was really, it almost reminded me of, again, me and my movie reference, like the Princess Bride
Okay.
When they're introducing Princess Buttercup and like everyone's quiet and they're like, and then the old woman's like, boo, yes, boo, yes. Nail okay. down to her.
Got it. Like a crowd yes. receiving someone. Yes. There's an event. I get you. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Do you remember that point in the Princess Bride?
I do. Yeah. That's a great
part.
That's
movie. A great part. Yeah.
And also we were picking up on figures from pre-revolutionary era. Right?
Like we
Nathaniel Hale kept coming up and again and again. And in the notes, I was writing pre-revolutionary. This is colonial times that we're picking up on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. And we stopped at Witter Cemetery in yes. Brooklyn, and we were really drawn to those pre-Revolutionary War dates on the headstone. So we had a time frame for our story.
Yes. And then we arrived in Hampton, Connecticut, which is a very cute town.
Charming.
Right. And it felt and looked like a historical town. And as it turns out, it was. It is.
It was. And but what was confusing about it is that the established date on the sign was 1785. And we're like, that's after the war.
Right.
So we had to do some digging about before the Revolutionary War in the area.
Exactly. And we did.
So can you tell us a little bit about Hampton, Connecticut?
Absolutely. Hampton is situated in northeastern Connecticut, and it dates back to the early 1700s when it was known as Wyndham Village. And the initial settlers were predominantly farmers, and they cultivated the land, and they grew crops, and they constructed homes and barns and mills, and they also harnessed water power for various industries. And by the time Hampton was established as a town in 1786, its population was comprised of farmers and craftsmen, merchants, educators, legal professionals, clergymen, and medical practitioners. And towns with diverse professions like all of these indicated a broadening of occupational roles, right? Beyond mm-hmm. that of just agriculture. And this diversification allowed for an increase in social mobility.
Okay, I'm tapping. Time out. Okay. So what you're saying is cash was becoming the new king over throwing land assets. Because before this, we see agriculture being like the money's in the land, right?
Right.
If you're a landowner, that's where your money is. But now people are making money a different way. They're being like blacksmiths and lawyers and educators. So cash is becoming the new big thing in town. And if you had a lot of land, that doesn't really mean anything anymore.
Right. I mean, we're seeing the rise of towns, the rise of more urban centers. And we're seeing diversification of professions.
Okay.
So not everybody needs a farm to be able to, not everybody's wealth is in the land. That is absolutely correct.
Got it. Okay.
So society is changing in important ways.
Okay.
Do you want me to give you an example of what that looks like?
Can you give me one specific example of how that looks like, Jennifer?
Absolutely. So one significant example of this changing culture in Connecticut in the 1700s would be the decline of the traditional concept of arranged marriages.
Oh my God.
Isn't that interesting?
What's interesting is that I did not think, when I think of an arranged marriage, I'm thinking of like Eastern culture. I'm thinking like old school England. I am not thinking about colonial America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Well, economic changes such as the growth of the market economy and the decline of land as the primary source of wealth reduced the economic incentives for arranged marriages, which had often been used to consolidate wealth and property within families.
I know what you said. I understand the words, but I'm not understanding exactly what you mean. Tell me what that looks like.
So back in the day, when everybody's wealth was in the property that belonged to the family, young people didn't just get to marry whomever they wanted because the elders in the family wanted the wealth to stay in the family. So they might be married to someone also in the family, maybe a cousin, or they might be married off to someone in their same social class, but hopefully just a little bit above them, right? Just a little bit above them.
Hopefully. I see. So again, with my media references, so we are talking Mary Downton Abbey. She is waiting for her cousin to come marry her so the money stays in the family because herself cannot inherit her father's land. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, that is one big reason, yes, for marrying. Also, someone like Mary in Downton Abbey or other women who had the advantage and the privilege of being part of the society where their family owned property, mm-hmm. they wouldn't really know anybody else other than, you know, the family and other families with, you know, land. So they didn't get around a lot, right? They didn't.
Oh, my God.
Do you know what I mean? There wasn't a lot of social opportunities to intermingle.
The genetic consequences of that must have been frightening.
Marrying like, within the family.
Like again and again and again and again and again.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of examples of why that is not ideal in history.
Give me one, because you mentioned something earlier that I laughed so hard.
Well, the Habsburgs, for instance, were like marrying within the family. And then at the end of it, you have all these hemophiliacs who their blood doesn't clot. So they like trip and fall and freaking die because their blood doesn't clot. Like, that's a problem. That is a problem. Kings and queens, stop doing that. And then I won't even get into the Egyptians. Like some of those later pharaohs, no. Just
oh,
no.
So bad.
Come on.
Cleopatra was married to her like younger brother who was like 7 years younger than her. It's embarrassing. It's like, poor Cleopatra.
Yeah. Anyway, so we're getting away from that. Yay. So in the 1700s yeah. in New England, we're getting away from that, right? We have the rise of true towns. There's a more modern approach with personal choice and financial independence, right?
Because personal choice and financial independence.
Right? Because you don't have to get your money from having it inherited to you. Now you can make your own money in town.
You can be like a bread maker.
Right.
A merchant.
Yes,
I'm
you
just
could.
Thinking, like,
right.
That's what I would be. I would be a bread maker.
Right. So to put a point on it, as people began to move more freely for work or other opportunities, they were less bound by the social structures and familial arrangements that often facilitated arranged marriages. And this mobility allowed individuals to meet potential partners outside of their immediate social and familial circles.
Thank God.
Thus increasing the chances of marriages based on personal choice rather than on arrangements.
Can we just end it here? It sounds so good. It's like we're going in the right direction.
The late 18th century saw a growing emphasis on romantic love, too, as the basis for marriage. Now, this is new, right? This whole mm-hmm. idea of marrying for romantic love.
I like it.
Yeah.
I'm a romantic.
This period often referred to as the Age of Enlightenment. Now, this was started around the late 17th century, and it continued through the late 18th century. And it was this time of great intellectual and social change, and it was marked by the rise of science and reason, and of course, individualism.
Love it.
And with that, a focus on reevaluating personal relationships and emotions. And the idea that marriage should be based on mutual affection and love rather than economic or social considerations. And there are some popular pieces of work that came out of the Age of Enlightenment that really illustrate this well.
I don't believe you. Give me one.
One of them is one of our favorite stories.
I love this story so much, stop it.
And
really
it
do.
Is Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen.
The woman's a master.
She really was. Okay, so
I love Darcy.
You love Mr. Darcy. Okay, so
I do.
So let's discuss. So you have Elizabeth Bennet. She's one of five daughters. Of course, she lives in England because all the great novels from this period come out of England. Sorry, the rest of the world, but it's true. And so you have Elizabeth Bennet. She's the second of five girls. And the Bennets are really nervous because Mr. Bennet's property can't go to any of his girls. By law, they cannot inherit the family wealth. So there's like a race, like, let's get these girls married off. Like, time is ticking, you know, like Mr. Bennet's getting older. We can't just wait around. So there's pressure.
Bullshit.
There's pressure on the girls to make a match. Okay. And you have this whole thing with Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy.
Well, not just a match, like a good match, right? Because you don't want her to marry some like vagrant. Right.
Here's the thing. Mr. Bennett and the Bennets do have property, but they're not wealthy. They're okay. Like, they're all right, but mm-hmm. they're not, like, high social class, I would say.
Got it.
Okay. So it's not like they go to work or anything, but they don't have a ton. They're not rich by any means. Okay. They're hoping for like a decent marriage at this point. Here comes Mr. Darcy. He's very wealthy, but Elizabeth doesn't like him. It's this whole thing. But then she finds out that he's really a better guy than she thought. So she's grappling with, you know, do I deserve to marry a man as wealthy as Mr. Darcy? Right. But also, do I love Mr. Darcy? At first, she doesn't. And that's a consideration, too, because I have to tell you in the book, Mr. Darcy's aunt, she is against the marriage because she thinks that marrying a Bennet is below him because of his social standing.
But Elizabeth, she was playing the pianoforte for her sister. And then Mr. Darcy came in and was like, I love you. And then she's like, I love you too. And then they get together and it's a happy ending. And it makes me very happy inside.
But there's another subplot I wanted to bring up here because it's super relevant to this story.
Tell me.
Well, Elizabeth had a younger sister named Lydia. It's always the younger sisters who get in trouble, by the way. So Lydia Bennet runs away with a cad named Wickham.
Fuck yeah, she does, Wickham.
Because she falls in love with this cad, Wickham, and the whole Bennet family is like distraught because she runs away with this guy and she's living with him out of wedlock. And you know what that means.
That means
they are banging. They are bumping uglies and everyone is
Lydia,
like, holy shit. Holy shit.
Lydia.
Our entire status as a Bennet household is going to go down if we don't do something right now. We have to find Lydia and Wickham and like have a marriage. Like ASAP.
You know what?
What?
She's living her best life and I think we should all just calm down. Lydia, do you, boo. Do you. Slut faming.
They find Lydia and Wickham, and Wickham agrees to marry Lydia for an annual allowance. So he's like, yeah, I'll marry her, but you have to pay me for it. And they're like, yes, whatever, because our entire family will be in disgrace if you two don't get married. They do, but then we find out that Darcy paid him off. And so, like, that's one of the endearing parts of Mr. Darcy and one of the reasons that Elizabeth, like, falls in love with him and it seals the deal, okay?
Well, I loved him before the Wickham situation.
So what we have here, but these themes, Jill, these themes are super pertinent and they really illustrate, like, women flouting society standards, right? They're starting to marry for love. It doesn't matter where you're from, right? Lydia's willing to marry this Wickham, who I think is just a military man. And Elizabeth is also marrying outside of her class by marrying Mr. Darcy. So they are flouting social standards. Also, they're marrying for love and outside of their class. And also, there are themes suggesting premarital relations are happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are. And let's not forget the limited options for all the women in the story.
Yeah.
So we have all of those themes, which are very relevant to our
current. And the pressure. Just the pressure of like your parents being like, we need to find someone for you girls to marry. I would be like, calm down.
Right. Exactly. Ugh. Exactly. And then that dilemma between should I just do it and make sure that I'm saving the family's wealth and the history, you know what I mean? And and future generations? Or do I
do... You would totally do that, by the way. That's a Jennifer thing. You would totally sacrifice. That makes me sad.
You marry for love, damn it. So there are these changing ideas about romantic relationships. And they, of course, lead to altered sexual behaviors, as we saw. And a notable increase in premarital conceptions, reflecting shifting values and the dynamics of New England and specifically Hampton, Connecticut's community, which was known as Wyndham back then. Yep.
I wouldn't know that from driving through that town because it looked cute and wholesome.
The rise in unmarried women having babies started to concern social elites at the time.
Someone was jelly.
In the past.
Look at all this haymaking. My goodness.
In the past, fornicators were forced to marry.
Like a shotgun wedding.
Like Wickham. Like, you guys, like Wickham and Lydia.
Yeah.
But unlike the Bennets in that fictional novel, Pride and Prejudice, many women lacked the resources to marry and raise a family. And poor single mothers would have been seen as a problem in the community. And the courts were compelled to target low-status women for illegitimacy and immorality. And those women of higher status or unfaithful men often escaped prosecution.
Well, ain't that some bullshit right there? So if you were an unmarried woman with a low social status back then, and heaven forbid you got pregnant, the courts were just on your ass and like, ding, 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 bring her in. We need to talk to her about morality and indecency, and we're going to prosecute her to the fullest extent of the law.
Yeah, that's right. They'd slap you with charges of illegitimacy. And that was just for starters. Immorality was the big scarlet letter they'd stitch on your reputation. We're talking about fines, public shaming, and that's not even the worst of it. There was even indentured servitude, which is labor with no pay to repay your debt to society.
And not only that, but these cases of illegitimacy and immorality were written in like official records. So like if you were doing a census, it would be like illegitimate child.
Wow. Like Hester, that's your personal whatever. Business. It doesn't belong in like official records.
Some shit. Bullshit. Mm-hmm. Mm-mm-mm. So how did women of the mid 18th century deal with unwanted pregnancies? Because they were finding love in the streets. How did they deal with it?
We've all heard of abortion, right?
Mm, it's a hot button issue here in the States.
Today it sure is. It still is, which is the deliberate termination of a pregnancy. And it's a practice that's been known since ancient times. This is nothing new.
I did not know that. Did you know that that abortion's been around since like ancient times?
Since ancient Egyptians.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go on.
Back in the mid-18th century in New England, women, especially low-status unmarried women, faced tough situations. They dealt with social stigma and the fear of punishment for having children out of wedlock.
They were dealing with this alone because the guy, obviously, didn't is have not to, around.
Right.
And there was no signs of the immorality, if you will.
Correct. Ugh. And this could lead some women to desperate measures, like trying to terminate their pregnancies. And they'd use things like black root and cedar root to try and end their pregnancies. And as you can imagine, some of these desperate women's measures to terminate the pregnancies didn't always work, Jill. And many women were forced to carry through their unwanted pregnancies to term. Luckily, English laws served to prosecute unwed mothers who harmed their babies.
Okay, so there was a law that was reestablished in the colonies based on this old-ass 1624 law. So, yeah. around the turn of the 18th century, they were like, hey, remember that bullshit law from England? Let's start doing it here.
Exactly.
And so that law was called the Act to Prevent or Destroy the Mothering of a Bastard Child. Tell me a little bit about the law.
Right. So the colonists took this out, dusted it off, and were like, oh, this will do. You know, we're having all these problems, so this will help. So this is a law that said, basically, if an unwed mother gave birth by herself and the baby died, it was seen as proof of murder.
Wow.
If the child was discovered deceased, officials would suspect the mother of trying to cover up the murder by claiming it was a miscarriage. And so to avoid being accused of murder, the mother had to have at least one person with her at the time of birth who could confirm the birth or stillbirth. And if a woman gave birth alone without any witnesses around, it could be hard to prove what happened, and the mother would be subjected to charges of infanticide, which carried the punishment of execution.
Okay, but we're talking 1700s.
Yes.
Colonial America, New England. Okay. Mm-hmm. Births and childbirth were dangerous in itself.
That is true.
And we
know. Especially for lower class women who didn't have any care.
Exactly. So if someone just like had a miscarriage, just like going throughout their day and no one was around to witness that event, they would just automatically be like, ah, we have a murder case, guys, bring her in, because no one was there to see what had actually happened to the child or the unborn fetus.
Potentially, yes. That was the law. If nobody was there and you were not married and something happened to your child, you were a suspect of murder. Yes.
Holy fuckery. That is some bullshit right there.
And it wasn't just like one or two times that this came up. There were 25 infanticide cases in Connecticut before the year 1790.
That's a lot.
I would. That seems like a lot to me.
That is a lot. So it seems like they were eager to take note of these women whose babies didn't make it or whose pregnancies didn't come to term. So what happened to these 25 cases?
Some unwed mothers were put to death in Connecticut. We know that to be true. But our story is about the very first person hanged in Windham County under this law. And her name was Elizabeth Shaw.
Tell me about Elizabeth. What were the circumstances?
Well, Elizabeth lived years before Hampton was officially established. And the details about her life are pretty scarce. But we do know some things about her.
Tell me. Tell me what we know.
Elizabeth Shaw was born in 1726.
Got it.
She was the very first daughter of William Shaw and Elizabeth Davis. And she was born in the area known as Windham, now Hampton, Connecticut. Now, they lived on a farm near Little River. The Shaw family were not wealthy by any standard. They had very limited means. They also had 7 children total.
That's a lot, man.
Historical records from Windham County describe Elizabeth as a simple girl. And not only that, she had, quote, perceived intellectual shortcomings. So that tells me that she was perceived to be cognitively deficit in some way.
Okay. Do we know anything else about her family? Are there any other records that indicate the personalities or intellectual ability of other members of her family?
Not so much intellectual ability, but we do know that her father, William, was known for being a stern man who had a very rigid demeanor. And that's really all we know. Did you find out anything else, Jill, in researching the Shaws?
No.
Okay.
But I did think it was interesting that the official record, like on just like court, not court, but like church documents, or like, and that William Shaw, he's a real bastard. You know what I mean? It was just like, wow, really?
Yeah, that's odd. But then again, they were writing down all kinds of inappropriate things in the records, apparently.
Weren't they, though?
Now, at the age of 18, in 1743, Elizabeth was already viewed as a burden to her family.
Why?
Well, because, number one, she was unmarried, and that's a burden. But also, she had this intellectual limitation. And it was known in the community. And so she wasn't a great catch, to put it very mildly.
And that's a terrible feeling.
And we don't know anything about what that cognitive disability would have looked like. We can only guess. But it's suffice to say, everybody knew.
That not just that she wasn't able to get married, or she wasn't an eligible bachelorette to get married, but also she was actually draining resources on her family,
yes,
who had 7 kids and they were poor already.
Right, exactly.
Ugh, yikes.
Hang in there, guys. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. We are so excited to unveil the first book in our series entitled Common Mystics Present Ghost on the Road Volume 1, Murders and Mysterious Deaths.
It's everything you love about Common Mystics and more.
It's a retelling of 10 of our favorite stories from our pod with exciting extras.
Extras like souvenirs, what we took away from the experience, and what to know if you decide to travel in our footsteps.
Pre-order the Kindle edition now. All other formats of the book will be available for purchase at Amazon.com on July 1st, 2023.
Thanks, guys. Now back to the show.
Now, during this time, Elizabeth became pregnant under very unclear circumstances. Nobody knows who the father of her child was, but it led to rampant speculation in the town regarding the identity of the father.
Oh, my God. And like the 1700s, like Hampton, Connecticut, I'm sure that
that's
this
a small
was like,
community. Everybody would be talking about it.
Everybody, especially because she was impaired.
Yes. Yes,
that
would exactly
have been quite the Okay, go on. Poor Elizabeth.
Elizabeth endured 9 months of scorn and taunting from the community throughout her pregnancy.
That's some bullshit.
So she was shunned by the town folk and even her own family because of this surprise pregnancy, and she faced shame and criticism. And yet, She was by herself on her farm in June of 1745 when she gave birth. Now, the strange part was that no baby was immediately visible. And though signs of birth were apparent, but it was her father, her own father, William, who reported the odd occurrence and the missing infant to the authorities.
Stop. I'm stopping it right here. I just want to say this out loud. So she is alone.
Yes. On her family farm.
She's on her family farm. Everyone's doing their thing.
9 months pregnant.
9 months pregnant. She comes back and it looks like she's like this belly's softened. There looks like indications that the pregnancy is over, but there isn't a child there.
Correct.
And instead of being like, oh my God, are you okay?
Right.
What happened? Like her dad does what?
He reports it to the authorities.
Oh.
So he goes to the authorities and says, my daughter was alone and gave birth. You need to come investigate.
What a prick. Okay, continue.
This leads to Elizabeth's quick arrest, and she is thoroughly examined by 12 women.
I just want to put my arms around this poor Elizabeth and hold her.
The physical exam indicated that she had indeed given birth. And then the hunt for the baby started, ending sadly with the discovery of a lifeless newborn child among the rocks by a ridge overlooking the town. After these tragic events, a grand jury looked into the case and decided that there was enough evidence to support a trial. And Elizabeth was locked up in Windham Jail, awaiting her trial. Now, you can imagine that there was significant public interest in this case. Mm-hmm. And it drew a large crowd of town residents to the trial. In the presence of an all-male judge and jury, the charges against Elizabeth Shaw were publicly announced. Elizabeth Shaw, a single woman from Windham, allegedly concealed and abandoned an illegitimate child in the woods of Windham, leaving it to perish due to a lack of care. She also attempted to conceal the birth and subsequent events, preventing the truth from surfacing about the fate of the child, whether it was born alive or not. That's what she was accused of.
And what did she plea?
Elizabeth pled not guilty. But the facts of the case were established that Elizabeth had given birth alone, and no one was there to witness the condition of the infant.
But what about the circumstances that, number one, she was already perceived like she had a deficit in her intelligence? Like, what wouldn't that be like, hey, we're not even sure how this pregnancy took place? Wouldn't that be looked at as some kind of like extenuating circumstances?
I would think so. Or the fact that maybe she didn't even comprehend the situation she was in fully. You know what I mean? But they weren't considered at all. Any of those mitigating circumstances were not in consideration according to the court record.
Wow.
And the jury found her guilty. Guilty, and they delivered the verdict. Elizabeth received the sentence of death by hanging on November 18th of 1745.
Oh, God.
On the day of her execution, as the clock struck noon, a large crowd gathered at the gallows site, and the cart carrying young Elizabeth made its way through the streets. She was distraught, of course, and prayed feverishly. The weight of her fate was heavy upon her, and it was at the intersection of a road from Windham to Mansfield where the sheriff, a stern-faced man with a heavy heart, carried out the grim task. And the crowd stood in silence as the noose tightened and the tragic scene unfolded before them.
After Elizabeth hung until death, they cut her down, but no one knows exactly where she was laid to rest. According to legend, around town, like urban legends, they say that you can still hear Elizabeth's fingers tapping against the pine box somewhere, echoing through the streets of what is now Hampton, Connecticut.
Wow. Another tale states that Elizabeth's spirit still roams the roads of Hampton to this day and lingers in the town.
I mean, I hope something. You know what I mean? Like, this This is crazy.
And I mean, I don't know about all that, but she's definitely coming out to us. She's definitely coming through. I believe she's not at rest.
I believe she's not at rest. And my stomach is like, I'm gutted for this poor deer. Mm-hmm. Like her soul feels, yes, sad, but she seemed like such a happy girl, like a happy spirit.
Mm. I agree. I know.
This is completely heartbreaking, this story on so many levels. It isn't lost on me that Elizabeth may have been a victim of non-consensual sex, right? This is totally, she had cognitive impairments or deficits that someone in that condition really can't give consent.
Right.
So she herself is a victim. And I'm just wondering, from our research, did you find anything on the books to protect women from sexual predators or rape in, I don't know, the English colonies in North America? Because that would have been great.
Well, in those days, rape was considered a capital offense.
Yet, oh, good.
Yet enforcing the laws proved challenging, resulting in very rare convictions. From 1694 to 1742, no gallows were built for rapists sentenced to death. The absence of laws against attempted rape left jurors and judges with only two choices, either acquit or sentence them to death. In three quarters of the 1700s, Connecticut saw just two men convicted and hanged for rape, both of whom happen to be black men. These convictions then and now reflect some biases rather than any compelling evidence.
Yeah. And I just want to be clear about the lack of evidence.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? The lack of evidence.
When a woman has sex, the obvious result is a child, right? There's no denying that. That's what we would call evidence that the woman had sex. But there is no evidence that a man has had sex, right? So that puts the women in a disadvantage.
Right. Not even if the woman said, that is the man that put his seed in me and now it's growing. This is his child. That is not considered
evidence.
Evidence.
Physical evidence. I mean, you've got the baby is the physical evidence. Like the pregnancy is the physical evidence. For the man, there's no physical evidence. At least then.
Some shit like when the kid like grew up to be like 18 and it looked just like the dude. You know what I mean? Then it would be like, hey, can we relook at that? Because
that's a good idea.
Yeah. So what do you think Elizabeth wants us to know about her life and her death?
Poor Elizabeth. I have so many questions about how this all went down. I have questions about if her family knew that she was vulnerable, why her family did not take every precaution to protect her.
And I understand exactly what you're saying. I want to say pregnancy and during the pregnancy. Like
if
both, like you know you have a vulnerable person in your family that you should love and circle around.
Yes.
And make sure that they're safe.
Yes.
Whether and then she ends up pregnant. Okay.
Right. And then double down on that. Now we have to be with her because we know that she's vulnerable to these laws. She's unwed. Mm-hmm. Right.
And we're not sure even what her comprehension was to those laws or about those laws or any laws for that matter.
Or about what was happening in her own body.
Or what happened to her.
Right. She deserved the utmost care and protection. But instead, she's left alone at the end of her pregnancy. She was home. She was on her family farm. And yet nobody was with her. So I have so many questions. There are so many red flags in my head. And I hate knowing that she was a burden to her family because to me that screams motive, but I don't want to go there. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I just know.
I know our patrons are going to send us emails. And I know. And I love you all. And I'm waiting for them because trust me, you guys, you know who I'm talking to. I'm thinking the same thing you're thinking. Write us. We'll chat. You know it.
Right. Is there anything you want to add to that?
I'm waiting for you to tell me.
But there's more.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's more. Like, that's not enough, right?
Yeah. If you're already angry and want to burn some shit down because of the laws in colonial North America and because of the treatment of poor Elizabeth Shaw, but wait, it's worse. Please, Jennifer, tell us.
So 27 years, almost 30 years after poor Elizabeth is executed,
murdered,
her memory is resurrected by the community.
Were they thinking as retrospectively like, hey, we got that one wrong?
Not at all, Jill. Not at all. You see, it was, again, the Age of Enlightenment was taking root, and you have all of these big social changes, changing attitudes, women having premarital sex. And there were two notable cases in 1772 that brought this to a head in the community. And one was a case of infanticide in Massachusetts. The Connecticut Gazette and other newspapers carried reports of the incidents. And one of the cases involved a woman named Sarah Goldwaith, who was accused of the unthinkable act of tying stones around her newborn son and casting him into a pond in Lynn, Massachusetts.
I cannot.
The second case recounted the discovery of a newborn in the Charles River, suspected to be a victim of its unmarried mother.
What does any of this have to do with Elizabeth? This is tragic and horrible, but what are we talking about this 30 years later?
So people are horrified that this is happening. And so they resurrect the memory of Elizabeth in the form of a written pamphlet that depicted her in a Christian rhyming verse, painting her as an immoral woman, forever immortalized in the annals of history. The concluding verse served as a cautionary message. It said, "Oh, may we all who hear her fall a timely warning take. Let's not delay another day before we sin forsake." In other words, let's not do what Elizabeth did. Let's forsake sin and save ourselves from the gallows. Wow. Yeah.
You know, I have a whole speech that I prepared for this moment, but I'm just going to let it simmer. And I don't want to feed our intelligent, thoughtful audience and friends that we have listening to this. I want them to think about unpacking this story and the historical context of rights of women and rights of vulnerable people in society. And I just want to leave it there. I think less is more here, because I can't think of anything more like an absolute, like, that is completely off the wall. Like, to be like, no, remember Elizabeth Shaw, the first woman in our county that we killed? It's because she had sex, had a baby, and then she killed the baby. So remember, when you guys are all horny, that can happen to you. Tread lightly. When that is not the story of her life at all.
Correct. And I think that's a big reason that Elizabeth is reaching out to us, because that was not her story. She wasn't an immoral person. She wasn't a sinful person. She was a victim in more than one way.
Of child abuse, number one. Of rape, I would say, number two. Of murder, I would say, number three.
Absolutely.
And then to add injury to insult, to double down on this bullshit and to put it in a pamphlet to be like, hey, ladies, watch out. It's like, fuck you. Mm. Anyway, sorry. Okay, sorry. I'm sorry. Was it too much?
A little bit.
Did I go too hard?
I'm hearing you suggest that some of these themes are relevant today.
Yes. And they make me angry today. But most of all, can I be completely honest with you?
Sure.
Literally, I've been trying to think about not the way Elizabeth was destroyed, but how she lived. And when I think about her as a person, I can see her like being, enjoying nature and like looking at wildflowers and just feeling very happy. She just feels like a happy, happy soul before all this happened.
Mm.
Just saying. That's just me.
Should we go over our hits?
Yeah, let's do it. Why not?
Tell me about Route 6. Why was that significant that we were on Route 6 and that you noted that it was haunted?
Because one of the legends is that the crossings between Route 6 on Route 6 and another road where she was hung is haunted.
Really?
Yeah, that was a direct hit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is weird because it was like you wrote it and then like I piggybacked on your hit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. A persecuted woman, I think that is self-explanatory. Clearly, mm-hmm. Elizabeth was persecuted, but not just her, like all of the other unfortunate women who were prosecuted legally for reasons outside of their control many times outside of their control. Not always, but still, laws weren't fair, and that sucks. Oh, Hester Prynne was Jill. This blows my mind. This is such a good hit. It's like a direct hit here, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because Hester had a baby out of wedlock as well and was publicly shamed.
Right. Right.
Just like Elizabeth, obviously.
Can I ask you a question about the detours right now?
Sure.
You had a wonderful idea for the detours revolving around Demi Moore's star-studded performance in The Scarlet Letter. So please tell our listeners what they can expect on next week's detours.
So we have decided that we are both going to watch the Razzie-winning Scarlet Letter with Demi Moore from 1995, which I hear is one of the all-time worst movies ever made. And so, yeah, we're going to watch that and we are going to discuss and just have
fun.
We're going
to Cisco and Ebert that motherfucker. That's what we're going to do. That is what we do.
I don't think I've seen it. Have you seen it?
You know what? I think I have, but like
not purposely.
I think
I've tried. I remember trying to watch it and being like, yeah, no, I can't. But I'm gonna push through for you listeners, for you patrons on the detours. I'm going to do this. I mean, it's no matter how much it hurts.
We love you. We love you. That's what we do for you. And then the next week we're watching The Seventh Sign. And again, it's terrible. Demi could have done better.
So feeling despair and people giving their lives. I mean, come on. That's all very relevant. Tell me about the gathering on the square. This is chilling.
Because sick, bored people in the 18th century would like be like, hey, there's a hanging. Let's go check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's that.
And the fact that we were so picking up on pre-revolutionary times is interesting because that confused us at first because we stopped at Hampton and we're like, wait a minute. Hampton isn't a pre-revolutionary war community because it was established in the 1780s. But then with the research, we realized that it was before that town was established. It was that time that we were picking up on, which was indeed pre-revolutionary America.
I love spirit when it gives us those kind of hits so that you know where to look. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with the Witter Cemetery in Brooklyn. It was like, hey, girls, you guys are keep focusing on or keep getting your eyes catching these dates.
Yep.
So, yeah, it really gave us a time frame.
Okay, so Jill, I said we were going to end on a high note. So you're up.
Yeah.
Give us a high note.
Okay, a high note.
Yes, okay.
I don't
dig
know.
Dig deep and pull some sunshine out of this.
This is a good thing.
Oh, okay. I'm ready for it.
In the past 300 years, almost 300 years, because Elizabeth Shaw was born in 1726, now we're talking about her and giving her full story out there.
Yeah.
She was a victim of rape. She was not able to consent to sex on any level. And then the people that were supposed to love her and protect her because she was vulnerable, not only didn't, but her asshole father turned her in to be murdered.
Yep.
So even though it's late, Elizabeth, we hear you, we see you, we love you, and we're sorry that happened to you. And I hope that we can learn from the tragedies and the laws of your time. What do you think? Did I do good?
Yes, I like it. And I also want to say one thing, and that is the original English laws that were so effed up to unmarried mothers probably had some good intention behind them. Because they wanted they wanted to protect the babies. That was the point, right? Like you're going to be in trouble if you don't protect your baby. Okay. And so I think we have, you see what I'm saying? So I think.
I see what you're saying.
So I think that moving forward, just being thoughtful about unintended consequences for laws that maybe have like good intentions. Do you know what I'm saying?
I can see that. Yeah. I can see that. I'll meet you there.
Okay.
Thank you for meeting me there. I don't like babies suffering. I'll tell you that.
Of course not. Nobody does.
Nobody does.
Nobody does.
That's not a thing. No one enjoys, like, I know enjoys that. No, it's not a thing.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, agreed.
Okay.
We can all agree on that.
We can all agree on that. Okay, thank you.
Love babies.
All right.
Okay, so Jennifer.
Yes.
Let me tell the people where they can find us.
Why don't you do that?
Well, please check out our website, commonmystics.net. Follow us on our socials at Common Mystics Pod.
Please listen in wherever you're listening to your favorite pods.
Please consider leaving us a positive review. We love reading them and sharing them on our socials.
Please subscribe, download, like, and share.
Yes, yes, yes. Share, share, share. Thank you guys so much. We love you. Thank you for listening. We know this was a hard story this week. Mwah.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. This has been a Common Mystics Media production. Editing done by Yokai Audio, Kalamazoo, Michigan.